It's great that you told these jokes because I was so worried I was run out of jokes for the day. And so then so I couldn't remember any reasonable jokes to tell anymore, but I wanted to tell you some stories of the Institute for Advanced Study, where I worked for 5 years, and I had great esteem there. I loved it very, very much, and I met people there who knew Einstein and who knew Gödel. And for example, Freeman Dyson knew Gödel. And Freeman Dyson was a very young professor at the Institute for Advanced Study, and one day he gets a phone call from Gödel. And Gödel was very nervous, and Gödel says, "I received this parcel in the mail." You know, Gödel was very paranoid. "I received this parcel in the mail. It's this huge parcel, and it's very light and empty, and I'm very worried that somebody has sent me poisonous gas and wants to kill me." And then he said, "Would you please be so kind to open it for me?" And Freeman Dyson was so amazed that the greatest logician sort of the century wasn't very logical sort of in his everyday. And Freeman Dyson said, "Okay, Professor Gödel, I come to your office immediately." And he said, no, I bring it to your office." And the girl brought it to your office and left immediately. And then Dyson opened it, and it was a paper surface, a paper structure, some mathematical surface that Gödel had calculated. And then Dyson phoned Gödel and said, "Can I bring it to your office?" He said, no, you keep it. He didn't want to have it. And the other thing is that, you know, John von Neumann considered himself a failure because he considered himself only to be the third best mathematician he had ever known, kind of. And then, so he's always curious as to who are these other two mathematicians that he ranks himself better. One of them was this guy, Siegel, at the Institute for Advanced Study. And Siegel proved some Hilbert conjectures but found it so easy he didn't even bother to publish it. But every year, Siegel would hold a strawberry party. And every year he would send out printed invitation cards for the strawberry party, and they had crosses on them that said, "You are invited," and "You are not invited." And he would then just check whatever would apply to you and send you the appropriate invitation. It's very funny, but makes very much sense to me, because if you don't get an invitation, how should you know whether it was lost in the mail? So it's very precise, I think, to actually receive an invitation that says, "You are not invited." So today I wanted to end this talk, this series of talks, actually by giving you a little bit of more flavor of the kind of mathematics that we are using here, rather than talking about a third independent subject. So I remind you again what I said in my first two talks. What is evolution? What is it that evolves? Populations evolve. It's a beautiful book by Ernst Mayr, who was a great evolutionary biologist, not at all mathematical evolutionary biologist, but he died at the age of 101. He was a Harvard professor. I think when he was 100 in that year of his life, he published two books. One was an 800-page monograph on butterflies, and the other one was a book on what evolution is. And so in the review, the reviewer said he's slowly gathering speed in his publications. But so he wrote very beautifully, what is it that evolves? Populations evolve. Only populations evolve. Figuratively, we say genes evolve, cells evolve. That's not really true. The only thing that can really evolve, also not species don't evolve, populations of reproducing individuals. So evolution needs populations of reproducing individuals, and individuals, reproducing individuals, are information carriers. So you can think of genetic reproduction, or you can think of cultural reproduction. And then reproduction with mistakes, that is mutation. And reproduction at different rates, that is selection. So see, the whole story of evolution is so simple. That's all there is to it. And then this also suggests the equations that we want to study. So the idea is that you have a population, and then you have a mutation, and then you have selection. That's the underlying idea of evolution. So then you have to make a choice. So you can say, I want to study deterministic evolutionary dynamics. I want to write down differential equations that describe this change. And implicitly, what you're assuming here is always infinitely large population. If you're willing to allow differential equations to describe your system, actually you also make the assumption my system is infinitely large, because if my system would have finite size, there would be stochastic effects. So there are equations for this, and there are books have been written about this, and for example, a very, very important book is Hofbauer and Siegmund on the replicator equation. The first person who studied the replicator equation was Canadian, was Peter Taylor, in 1978 approximately. So it's the quasi-species equation. So there are systems of differential equations here that I also describe in my book, sort of as an introduction to this. But what I want to do in this talk, mostly I want to talk about the stochastic side of it. So if we want to go to the stochastic evolutionary dynamics, we are now dealing with finite populations. We are dealing with small populations, but we are dealing with arbitrary large but finite populations also. So for stochastic evolutionary dynamics, a very useful process is the Morin process. Corina mentioned the Wright-Fisher process. The Wright-Fisher process assumes discrete generations, like all individuals reproduce, and then we have a new generation. The Morin process has more continuous time. It's more continuous time. So the Morin process, there's a population here, and then you choose an individual for reproduction proportional to fitness. So you say there's some fitness, maybe red has fitness twice as large as blue. So at random, you choose an individual for reproduction at random but proportional to fitness. And then you choose one for death. Choose one individual for death, it can even be the same one. So simultaneously, you choose one for reproduction, one for death. And then the offspring of the first individual replaces the second individual. That's one elementary step in this stochastic process. And we do this because we want to keep the total population size absolutely constant. We don't want fluctuation in total population size. That would bring us to two-dimensional stochastic process where the analytic solution is very hard. So we want to keep things simple at first. So then what you notice is the Morin process is a birth-death process. A very good book on the mathematics of these things is, for example, Carlin and Taylor, a first course in stochastic processes also. So the Morin process is a birth-death process because the only thing that can happen is I either have one more blue or I have one less blue. I can only make one step right or one step left. So then I have a probability here. I can write down transition probabilities, the probability to go from 1 to 2, the probability to go from 2 to 1. I have a transition matrix for the stochastic process, which is tri-diagonal. A tri-diagonal transition matrix is a birth-death process. So the state space is the number of blue individuals, say, goes from 0 to n, and then I have the stochastic transitions. So then, without mutation, the stochastic process has two absorbing states. Without mutation, if it's all red, it will stay all red. If it's all blue, it will stay all blue. All other states are transient states. If you wait long enough, you will get out of them. But these states, once you're there, you will never leave them. So therefore, what we want to calculate in biology most of all is we introduce a new mutant, and we want to know, does the new mutant take over the population, or does it become extinct again? So we call this here the fixation probability. Rho, we call fixation probability of the new mutant. This new mutant is fixed in the population. This is a typical question that people have asked in population genetics already in the 1920s, 1930s. The Morin worked on this process in the 1950s. That was an Australian population geneticist. So we want to calculate the probability that you go from I equals 1 to I equals n, and this is just also 1 minus the probability that you lose it again, because either you go all the way or you lose it, you can't stay in between. There are only two absorbing states. And so then if we say that the relative fitness of this blue mutant is R, and the fitness of the resident mutant red is 1, so R is R relative to 1, then the fixation probability can be proven to be this quantity here. And this just, you calculate the fixation probability of this stochastic process. And that's the formula for it. And now we have solved the problem for constant selection. Constant selection means that no matter where you are in the system, the fitness is always R. In many cases in evolution, we don't have constant selection. This is what we want to go next. But the simple system of constant selection, that's the answer. And this equation, if R goes to 1, then the fixation probability goes to 1 over n. Now this we know without doing any calculation, it must be like this. Because if everybody has the same fitness, and then I ask you, which of these individuals will win the world? It's any one individual with the same chance. So the fixation probability must be 1 over n. The fixation probability of a neutral mutant, we say, is 1 over the population size. And now comes a very interesting result. We can say, what is the rate of evolution in that system? The rate of evolution is the rate at which new mutants accumulate in the population. So the rate of evolution is the population size times the mutation rate times the fixation probability. So in each generation, how many mutants do you produce? N times U. And then how many of them make it? It is rho. Rho make it each generation. So each generation, N times U times rho is the number of mutants that kind of make it. And now if you have neutral evolution, the rate of neutral evolution where R equals 1, it means rho equals 1 over N, it is the mutation rate. And this is a famous result by Moto Kimura, a population geneticist in the 50s, 60s. It is the molecular clock. The rate of evolution is just the mutation rate. So Kimura looked at like genes, say he would ask, let's look at genes that differ between us and chimpanzees, or between us and mouse. And then let us see these substitutions that we find there, what do they do? And people were sort of surprised to find most of substitutions we find there, they don't do anything. So Kimura said, all substitutions, they do nothing. That's the neutral theory of evolution. It's just an accumulation of neutral mutation over and over. And therefore there is a molecular clock, because the rate of evolution is just the mutation rate. If advantageous mutations would be very important, we cannot cancel the population size. And therefore fast populations would evolve, big populations would evolve faster. So this was constant selection, but now more interesting for us is evolutionary game theory. So evolutionary game theory is, fitness is not constant, but it is frequency dependent. So the fitness is not R, but the fitness depends on where you are in the stochastic process. So for example, I could do very well if I'm doing something that nobody else does, but if everybody's doing this, I could do badly, or the other way around. So evolutionary game theory is something that was invented by John von Neumann. John von Neumann invented game theory, and John Maynard Smith brought game theory to biology. But evolutionary game theory is not something weird or special, it is actually the generic approach. Because what is not evolutionary game theory would be constant selection. Now constant selection, that's something rare. Typically we are dealing with frequency dependent selection. And the beautiful thing that is also shown in the book by Hofbauer and Sigmund, the fundamental equation of evolutionary game dynamics, the replicator equation, is mathematically equivalent to the fundamental equation of ecology, the Lotka-Volterra equation. There is a bijection between the orbits of the Lotka-Volterra equation and the replicator equation. Whatever theorem you have for one system, you also have for the other. So I want to say all of ecology is evolutionary game theory. I can also make an argument that all of infection dynamics is evolutionary game theory, because typically the fitness of a host depends on how many parasites there are around. And interactions between viruses and immune systems, they are games. They are games in the sense that the fitness is not constant. Yes, so HIV, we wrote down HIV equations, and sometimes I thought I'm now writing a new equation, but then I realized it is an equation of game theory. So let us play this game. So the game is described by a Bayes matrix. And the Bayes matrix means that if two individuals interact, their fitness is A. This is what we had with the prisoner's dilemma, for example. If A interacts with B, the fitness is B. B from A gets C, and B from B gets D. So I meet another person, and this is what I get. And this Bayes matrix, now in biology, it leads to the definition of fitness. What is the fitness of A? The fitness of A is A times X, where X is the frequency of A. Little x is the probability I meet another A person. And 1 minus x is the probability I meet another B person. So the fitness of A is this linear function of x. Here we have an important restriction of generality, because we deal here with frequency-dependent fitness, but only with linear function. Most of this is only with linear function. There are very few results with nonlinear function. I think nothing can be proven. Once you go to nonlinear functions, everything is possible. But we deal with linear function. So the idea is that the interaction can be described by a game, and then my fitness depends on these interactions that I have described by this Bayes matrix. Pairwise interactions. I can also write theory for n-person game. It will lead to nonlinear fitness function, but there is some, you can do something with this. But if we stay with these two strategies A and B, I can now give a classification of the deterministic selection dynamics, which would be described by replicator equation. And this is if A is greater than C and B is greater than D in this matrix, then selection always points to always to all A state. So the system will always be driven to a population that is homogeneous for A. This is stable equilibrium and this is unstable equilibrium. And this up here, this means this condition here, A greater than C is AC, it means if everybody is A, if everybody is A, what is it better? Is it better to play A or B? It is better to play A. See, because A is greater than C. If everybody plays A, it is better for me to be A also. And this condition here, B greater than, if everybody is B, it is better for me to be A than B. Therefore, if I'm here, everybody's A still wins. If I'm here, everybody's B, A wins. This is how you explain this selection dynamics. But down there, A is greater than C, but B is less than D. What we have here is now, it is better to play the strategy of whatever is more common. So most people play A, it's better to play A, but most people play B, it is better to play B. So therefore, we have an unstable equilibrium here, and we have two stable equilibria. So this is a Nash equilibrium, and here we have two Nash equilibria. This is the definition of Nash equilibrium. In biology, we call this evolutionarily stable strategy. There's only a small difference. We can also have this situation here, we have a stable equilibrium of the mixed strategy. Mixed state is stable. Oh, the dynamics is given by the replicator equation. So this is this fitness function, and then I would have that, say, xA dot equals xA times fA. Do I call this up there, what is written here is fA. This is the fitness of A, FA, minus, and then average fitness. And so then XB is XB, FB minus average fitness. So average fitness is XA, FA plus XB, FB. This is a, so then you have the additional constraint XA plus XB equals 1. It's an equation on the unit interval 0, 1. So the n-dimensional replicator equation is an equation on the simplex SN.
Relation to the pairwise interactions, then you have the sequence of this equation.
If you have more than two strategies, n strategies, you have n equations here defined on the simplex SN. So now we say A is a strict Nash equilibrium if A is greater than C. In this case, A is an evolutionarily stable strategy. So strict Nash equilibrium would be that A is greater than C, and Nash equilibrium is A greater or equal than C. That's the difference between Nash and strict Nash. So strict Nash equilibrium means if we both play strategy A, you cannot switch to any other strategy and get more. There's no incentive to deviate from the Nash equilibrium if we both play it. But now let's go to finite population. So how do we make a theory for finite population? Because this is a theory for infinite population size. But biological populations are not infinite, so we want to study finite population. So we want to say now there are I many A players, there are N minus I many B players. And then the payoff for A is this here. We can also divide by N minus 1. That's the payoff for B. So I have each A player has I minus 1 other A players. And I have N minus I B players as possible opponents. But as a B player, I have I other A players and N minus I minus 1 other B players. So I do not play with myself. And now in finite population, the intensity of selection matters. This is very interesting because in infinite population, this does not matter. In infinite population, you can write it like this if you like, but it cancels out here. Once you go to here, it would cancel out. So people don't bother about this. But in finite population, it doesn't cancel out, and it's very important to realize this intensity of selection. So what we say now, the fitness of A is Fi plus W times the payoff, where that now measures the intensity of selection. And if W is small, we are in the case of weak selection. And this is not a very curious thing, because economists have studied questions in finite population, but they have not derived results that are similar to our results because they do not have a concept of weak selection. For them, this is very surprising. For biologists, this is very natural, because in population genetics, this is always what is being done. You assume that any one mutation has a small effect. So now we want to know the fixation probability of A, the same as before, but fitness is not constant. And now this is the answer. You can still calculate it for the first test process, it's a sum over product. And now what you want to know is if rho is greater than 1 over n, then selection favors A replacing B. So if this is greater than 1 over n, it is better than a neutral mutant. If something is better than a neutral mutant, it is an advantageous mutant. So that needs to be calculated, and what we have to ask is, when is this greater than 1 over n? That's what you want to know. And so if this is greater than 1 over n, the cool thing is, for large population size and weak selection, so in general, it is not easy to write this inequality, but for weak selection and large population size, you get a very simple answer. And the answer is rho is greater than 1 over n if A plus 2B is greater than C plus 2T. So in some sense, you look at the Bayes matrix here, and you say A plus 2B is greater than C plus 2T, and then you are favored in finite population size. This is very, very beautiful because there's a famous concept in game theory which is called risk dominance. Risk dominance is A plus B must be greater than C plus D. And in a coordination game, this condition is it has the bigger basin of attraction. This was an important notion of Reinhard Felten, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, and this risk dominance was one of the things that he sort of promoted very much for coordination games. So this life inequality also has a beautiful interpretation. It is what we call the one-third rule. Selection favors A replacing B if the fitness of A is greater than the fitness of B at frequency one-third. So you have here the fitness, the frequency spectrum, and then you have these linear fitness functions. They can be either like this, or both of them rising or so. All you have to ask is, at point one-third, is fitness of A greater than fitness of B or not? And if at point one-third fitness of A is greater, it is an advantageous mutant. This is very surprising. This is very surprising for us. And it works in so many processes. It works in the Morin process, it works in the Wright-Fisher process, it works in every process we can imagine which is reasonable. You can construct processes that are exceptions, but they are also very abstract processes. But so why do we have this one-third rule? Is there an intuition behind it? Here's the intuition. What you do here is you start with 1A individuals and you sample all trajectories that start with 1A and N minus 1B individuals. So you sample over all these trajectories, some of them reach fixation, most of them go to extinction again. So many of them go up a little bit and then go down again. If you sample over all these trajectories and you ask, how often do you meet B and how often do you meet A? And the answer is you meet B twice as often as A. So this is his old B here. And so most of these trajectories, you're more down here than up there. If you sample over all these trajectories, you spend less time sort of up here than down there. And precisely, you spend time here such that you meet B twice as often. And that means that in that matrix, if you ask how important is it with respect to my average fitness, what is it? It is just A plus 2B because I meet B twice as often. If I'm a B player, my average fitness is C plus 2D because I meet B twice as often. So the average fitness of A greater than B, that's the one-third rule. And the decisive idea was actually given by a student in my class, Pedro Portalo. I described it to my students. We have this one-third rule. We don't know why it is there. And he started to work on it. It wasn't quite right. But then in the discussion with Isashi Otsuki, we figured this out precisely, that this was the intuition. And now, the great thing for this is like, it's like a new approach to what is important other than a Nash equilibrium. And what we learn from this is that a finite population need not choose the Nash equilibrium. So for example, if you have a game with three strategies here, and this strategy here is bistable with that strategy here, but here you are neutral or so, here you are dominated, so this is the only strict Nash equilibrium, The only thing you can say with the classical analysis of game theory, this is what must be chosen, it's the only Nash equilibrium, none of these others are Nash equilibria. But in finite population, you can actually have a situation where most of the time, or the majority of time, the stochastic process spends here. So we have another way to calculate what is actually a successful strategy in games other than Nash equilibrium. The important thing is that an infinitely large population typically always chooses the Nash equilibrium. A finite population need not choose the Nash equilibrium. And this has helped us to understand many things. And here's a research project with David Rand and others, which I like to call irrationality resolved. Because very often, people behave irrational in experiments that you perform with them. So for example, let us imagine there is a five-round prisoner's dilemma. I tell you, let's play the prisoner's dilemma five times between two people. Then you should think in the following way. In the last round, I should defect, because the last round is over afterwards. So in the last round, I should defect. I also expect you to defect in the last round. So therefore, if we both defect in the last round, it is as if it doesn't even matter what the last round is, so we should defect in the fourth round. Therefore, we should defect in the third round. Backward induction would tell you, defect all the time. Now, game theorists, they are amazed that people don't get it. People try to cooperate in a five-round prisoner's dilemma. They try to cooperate. It is not the case that most people just defect all the time. They seem to be unable to do backward induction. And so then we analyzed, actually, what would be the winning strategy in a finite population-sized game? And we realize in a finite population-sized game, it makes sense to cooperate. The winning strategy is a distribution. And then we ask, what's the experimental observation? The experimental observation is a distribution. We get perfect agreement between the theory and the experimental observation. So people, they are not stupid. They actually play the winning strategy in a finite population. It is as if their instincts were shaped from evolutionary history of rather small population. So now I want to go to evolutionary graph theory. What I have discussed so far was well-mixed population. Everybody interacts with everybody else equally likely. But in evolutionary graph theory, the individuals occupy the vertices of a graph, as we said, and the edges determine where to place the offspring. So here's the thing. All the previous work assumes the following thing. Any interaction between any two individuals is equally likely. But in reality, I interact with my friends and they interact with their friends. It is very unrealistic to assume I interact with everybody equally likely. That's what we wanted to capture with evolutionary graph theory. Some population structure, some social network. So let us first study the complete graph. So let us first study not games, but constant selection. And the first thing we realize is that a complete graph, that's like a well-mixed population. Complete graph is identical weights, means everybody interacts with everybody else equally likely, and then we have the Morin process. So the Morin process is given by the complete graph is identical weights, and we have this fixation probability. So evolutionary graph theory, as a special case, contains the standard approach, the well-mixed population. Then the next thing we studied was the directed cycle. The directed cycle is that each individual can sort of replace that individual and so on. This is actually a typo here. It should be a directed cycle. And then we can calculate the fixation probability for the directed cycle. And strangely, it's the same fixation probability as the Morin process. So we have a very different structure here, but the same fixation probability for a randomly placed mutant. The next thing we tried was a cycle. And this cycle here, it was in both directions, and again we calculated the fixation probability, was again the same as the Morin process. So slowly we began to wonder whether we can find any graph at all that would give us a different fixation probability. We also looked in the literature, because population geneticists had asked similar questions, how do spatial models affect fixation probabilities, and they have come to the conclusion more or less they don't change the fixation probability. But then, my student Erich Liebermann realized that the following theorem actually holds. Let us define the temperature of a vertex as the sum of all weights that lead into this vertex. So we consider now a weighted graph, and we write the weight, Wij, on the edge that connects I and J. And then we define the temperature of the vertex J as the sum over all I, Wij. And Erich's isothermal theorem states, if all vertices have the same temperature, then the fixation probability is equivalent to the Moiré process. So in this example that we have discussed before, all these vertices have the same temperature. They all have the same number of weights leading into them. As a consequence of this theorem, all symmetric graphs have the same fixation probability as the Moiré process. A symmetric graph is always isothermal. Symmetric graphs were exactly those structures that were studied by population geneticists. So the population geneticists never found a deviation here, because these graphs were symmetric. But here are some non-isothermal graphs. So this is a suppressor of selection. A suppressor, this would be like a line that starts here, it has a root, and or it's a burst that starts here, you go out there, and you ask, what's the fixation probability for a randomly placed mutant? So how do you calculate this? It's very easy to calculate. The chance that the mutant arises anyone here is just 1 over n. If the mutant arises here, here, or here, it will not reach fixation. The only mutant that can reach fixation has to arise in the root. So the chance that a mutant arises in the root is 1 over n. It is 1 over n here. The fixation probability is 1 over n. The amazing thing is it's 1 over n independent of the selective advantage R. It behaves always like a neutral mutant. Therefore, we call it suppressor of selection. Oops. So then it is very easy to note that all one-rooted graphs have fixation probability 1 over n. It can only reach fixation if it's here. If graphs have multiple roots, then a lineage arising from a single mutant can never reach fixation. A single mutant can never take over a graph with multiple roots. But then we ask the question, so we have suppressors of selection, can we construct amplifiers of selection? And Erez realized, first he realized that a star is an amplifier of selection. And a star has a vertex that's in the center, and then you go out and in here, and then this is a hot thing, because many things lead into it, and these are cold vertices, because only one edge goes into it. So there's a hot area and a cold area, and the fixation probability is this thing here. So if you look at that fixation probability, the same as before, but R goes to R squared. So what does this mean? If the advantage is, say, 2, now the advantage is 4. So you have amplified selection. The star is an amplifier of selection. Scale-free networks, they have these hubs. Like, that's like Google, and Google is connected to many things, right? Scale-free networks tend to be amplifiers of selection. But then Erez sort of wanted to get stronger and stronger amplifier of selections. And then he had the superstar. And the superstar is a strong amplifier of selection because you actually can guarantee fixation of any advantageous mutant. These structures became very fragile. If you cut certain edges, you completely destroy them. But it works in the following way here. Here's a root, and then you feed into these leaves. All of them feed into this thing here, then it goes back here. And then you can make these cycles longer and longer, and if you make these cycles longer and longer, you increase this k here, and therefore you make higher and higher selective advantage. So with this cycle here, 1, 2, 3, so k would be 3, so you have cubed the advantage. But if you make this cycle here longer by having more things here, you make it arbitrarily long. And by making it arbitrarily long, you guarantee the fixation of any advantageous mutant. So, and how did we come to think about this? We came to think about this because I was studying these models of cancer. And I asked myself, cancer is an evolution that nobody wants. This is an unfortunate evolution, and therefore there should be selection pressure to suppress this evolution. There should be selection pressure for all of multicellular organisms to suppress this kind of evolution that you don't want. How do you suppress evolution? You can reduce mutation rate. So the mutation rates that we have for somatic cell division are very low. We are paying a very, very big price for every single base that we copy, in the sense that there are many control enzymes running behind that would check for mistake and correct it. So we have reduced mutation rate maybe as much as possible within reasonable cost, metabolic cost. So the next thing is, how can you get rid of selection? I wanted to know, how can I get rid of selection? These suppressors are precisely the structures that get rid of selection. That suppressor was motivated by the script of the colon. This is like a burst, that this is the root here, and you have to mutate the root in order to take over the crypt with normal mutations. So that was a suppressor of selection. And this hematopoietic system, it's a suppressor of selection, because you have to make the mutation here in order to take over the whole system. So I argue all of our tissues where there is a risk of cancer, they are designed in order to suppress selection by design. In addition to this, you have slower cell division here and more accurate cell division here. So stem cells are paying even more price to have lower mutation rate. So this was the theory for constant selection on graphs. Let us now play games on graphs. So what we want to say now is this vertex is occupied by individuals, but they play different strategy. And again, we define the game with a payoff matrix. And the idea is you play the game with your neighbor, then you get the fitness. And now the curious thing is for games on graphs, you have to ask yourself very much, what is my update rule? In a normal, well-mixed population, you can also ask the question, what's the update rule? And many update rules still lead to the same outcome. Suddenly here, different update rules lead to different outcomes. And this is a bit, there's a long list of update rules that we have to consider, and it seems to be almost without end. We don't really have a classification yet of update rules. So here's a simple update rule, we call it birth test updating. First, you choose an individual for reproduction proportional to fitness, for example this one. Then, offspring replaces a randomly chosen neighbor. This is called birth test. But then we have another update rule, death birth. First, choose a random individual to die, and then the neighbors compete for the empty site proportional to fitness. You think it's almost the same, right? Could be almost the same. I can tell you, in this case, evolution of cooperation is never possible. In this case, evolution of cooperation is possible with the BC greater than K rule. So there are two questions that we ask here. When is the fixation probability of a randomly placed A mutant greater than 1 over N? So we want to have now evolutionary graph theory. We have a randomly placed A mutant. When is the fixation probability greater than 1 over N? Second question is, when is A stable against invasion by B? So this is, when is a homogeneous population of A on the graph stable against invasion by B? When is A a Nash equilibrium, an evolutionary stable strategy? These are two questions that we would want to ask in evolutionary graph theory. And so then the theory that was developed mostly by Hisashi Otsuki, it assumes random regular graphs of degree K. Random regular graphs, they are very convenient because as the population size increases, loops become longer and longer. And in the theory, you are very much worried by small loops. Short loops mess up the theory. You have a large population size, so the number of populations is much larger than the degree K. You have weak selection. Then you use what physicists call pair approximation. So you describe the whole dynamics by the probability of pairwise interactions. And then you have diffusion approximation, which means that you have a partial differential equation approach for the stochastic dynamics. And then the beautiful result was the following, that the graph induces a transformation of the payoff matrix. So if you are interested in a game given by a payoff matrix A, B, C, D, and you tell us you want to play it on a graph of degree K, then we can tell you, don't worry, always we can tell you immediately what the outcome is, just transform your payoff matrix in this way and play a normal game. Play a game as if you would play in a well-mixed population. And for birth-death updating, you have to use this transformation here, and for death-birth updating, it is death transformation. So therefore, we have a replicator equation on graphs. So the differential equation that describes how the frequency of strategies changes on a graph, it is a replicator equation. When Hisashi did this calculation, his final answer was an equation that did not fit on one page. It was very long, a very long equation. But we looked at these terms, and the terms were either linear or quadratic. It all looked like just there has to be a fitness function that we have to search for. And then we realized that we can write it as a transformation of this payoff matrix. That's a replicator equation on graphs. We have to transform the matrix. This is as long as you're willing to play on a regular graph of degree K with weak selection. So now we can say, what is the fixation probability? The fixation probability of A is greater than 1 over N if we have the same one-third rule. The same one-third rule applies now to the transformed matrix. If this is the case, then A is an advantageous mutant. Answer two, when is A a Nash equilibrium? You just use the transformed matrix. So when is A a Nash equilibrium? A is greater than C minus H. And that is the Nash equilibrium on graph. A is evolutionarily stable or Nash equilibrium against B if A is greater than C minus H. And now we have this, and we ask, what does it mean? Let's get the intuition. What does this equation intuitively mean? So let us derive the intuition for Nash equilibrium on graphs. I don't draw the edges here. I just imagine there's a homogeneous population on the vertices, all B, and now I sprinkle over some epsilon amount of invaders A. And now, because I have weak selection, what happens is now on a fast time scale, half of them will die out and half of them will reproduce. That's precisely weak selection. Otherwise, it wouldn't be weak selection. Weak selection means they're approximately the same fitness. If they're approximately the same fitness, it means half of them die out, half of them will reproduce. So now suddenly it's pairs. And now you can actually ask, can these pairs invade or not? That's what you have to ask. So these pairs, it means the following thing. At a steady state of the local dynamics, an A individual has one more A neighbor than a B individual. So you go to this pair here and say, what's the average number of red people around a blue person? It is zero. What's the average number of a red person around a red person? It is one. This is what we can prove with this method. For any, wherever you are in this frequency spectrum, you always have one more A around an A than you have A around a B. And if you can prove this analytically, and there's hope to prove this precisely without any approximation, because in the voter model you can almost prove this. Because here, in order to prove this, it's just neutral. Everything is neutral. If you can prove this rigorously, then all our results you could actually prove rigorously. But so far we have not succeeded to prove this rigorously, only approximately. So therefore, the proper invasion cluster is actually a half line. So the way how you have to think about invasion on a graph is, you have to ask, there's a competition between a blue and a red guy. What's the fitness of the blue guy? The fitness of the blue guy, you have to know how many blue neighbors there are here around these other neighbors. All other neighbors are blue because the epsilon frequency of red. But how many red neighbors are around these neighbors? One more than here. Then for some update rules, you must know the fitness of this here. So you have to know how many red neighbors are around here, one more than here. So you have this half line. And you have to ask, what's the chance that this edge moves in favor of red instead of in favor of blue? And if you do this calculation, you exactly end up with this Nash equilibrium. So that's precisely this the Nash equilibrium condition. The proper invasion cluster is the steady state of the local dynamics. And here's now a particular game, evolution of cooperation. So you use this payoff matrix, and then if we have test burst updating on a regular graph of degree k, cooperators are stable against invasion by the factors if bc greater than k, cooperators have a fixation probability also, the same condition holds. So for that matrix, the transformation leads to the same condition for Nash equilibrium and for advantageous mutant. Now, the next thing we might want to know is, what is the mutation selection balance on a graph? So we have small mutation rate and we have weak selection. So small mutation rate means very rarely you introduce a new mutant. And then once the new mutant is introduced, it will either die out again or take over. Then again, you wait for a very long time before you introduce another mutant. So the system is oscillating always between the homogeneous states. And what you want to know is, how often do I spend the time here? How often do I spend the time here? In a well-mixed population, the answer is all A is more frequent than all B if this holds. This is the famous condition of risk dominance. This is in a well-mixed population the case. And on a graph, we again have just a transformed matrix. The transformed matrix also determines the mutation selection balance on a graph. And then I wanted to mention just one new thing that we were working on, which then actually led to what Corina presented yesterday. So this is games in phenotype space. This is that there is like a phenotype space in the sense that the way how we look like, for example, or what we like. So I see another person and I realize this person has some similar background to what I have, or is very different to what I have, or likes the same music or something like this. And then I play the game dependent on how much perceived similarity there is. Maybe I cooperate with somebody who is similar, or maybe I like to cooperate with somebody who is different. I mean, you can just decide. So individuals have conditional strategy that depend on distance in phenotype space. Individuals reproduce proportional to fitness. Offspring inherit the phenotype that is similar to the parent. And that's a project with Tibor Antal, Hisashi Otsuki, John Wakely, and Peter Taylor from Queen's University. And this is a computer simulation of this process. This is how the population drifts in phenotype space. So the first thing you can prove is that it doesn't actually branch into different clusters, because if the population breaks up into a cluster, after some time one of them will die out and only one will. This is like a sampling effect that you have also in urn processes, in stochastic urn processes. If you have red balls and blue balls in a box and you draw them at random and replace them with finite population size, you always go to all red or all blue. You can't stay mixed. So in that sense, you can never really branch for a long time. And in order to calculate these three probabilities matter, and these are very similar to the probabilities that Corinna mentioned for evolutionary set theory yesterday. What you have to know is P1, the probability that I1 and I2 have the same strategy. Then P2, the probability that I1 and I2 have the same phenotype. And P3, the probability that I1 and I2 have the same strategy, and that I2 and I3 have the same phenotype. And now if we play the game cooperation phenotype space, so cooperators cooperate with all others who are similar enough and defect otherwise. So I cooperate if similar, I defect otherwise, but defect is always defect. I can now calculate the condition for the evolution of cooperation, and the beautiful thing that Tibor Antal found is cooperators dominate defectors if the benefit to cost ratio is greater than 1 plus 2 divided by square root of 3. And the funny thing is, it's a one-dimensional phenotype space, it's large population size, it's weak selection, low mutation rate, all parameters go out of the system and we end up with a constant number. We don't have an intuition for this number yet. But this is the answer for one-dimensional phenotype space, and if we go to higher dimension, it becomes easier and easier. And I think that Tibor has shown that from two dimension and higher, this answer is just one, right? And this is what Corinna presented yesterday, was this idea on evolutionary set theory. You play the game with others in the same set, inherit the set memberships and the strategies. And then in a certain limit, you can write the condition as this here. And again, these are the cooperators in all these projects. That's the end of my talk.